Hello, I'm Felix.
And this is
Silent Mark Trying His Best.
And I'm trying my best. Welcome to episode 5 of the podcast. Hope you're all doing well. I start off with an apology. It's an apology I do quite a bit on the show. I haven't done a show for a month. That wasn't for any other reason than I did have a few interviews lined up and they all kind of fell through, which is unfortunate. But we are back with a great episode, which I'll talk about in a bit. First off, I want to thank you all. Thank you all very, very much for listening to this shambles. The last 2 weeks, I haven't managed to talk to you about the last two podcasts we did, but my God, you guys have given me an amazing, amazing feeling about them. Again, I go to plays because it's what I do. And for the interview with John O'Sullivan, I managed to get 56 plays. Dog Park Dissidents last week, last episode 25. Don't sound like big numbers, but for me they're huge. So thank you all very much for listening and thank you for tuning in. This is a labour of love. I adore doing this. I adore having these chats to these people. And yeah, it means a lot that they do it and it means a lot that you listen. So thank you very much for doing so. We have a great interview today. One thing I do want to direct you to, I've kind of updated the website a little bit, silentmark.co.uk, and the thing is, I'm now kind of running out of interviewees. So if you know of anyone that you want to have interviewed for the podcast, let me know. Go to silentmark.co.uk and you can go to the thing down the bottom. It says where to find me and there's a little email button, or you can just email mark@silentmark.co.uk. that works too. Today's episode is with the one and only Ms. Chelsea Krister. Chelsea is a director, filmmaker, award-winning. We'll talk more about that in the podcast itself. She made the film Bleeding Audio, which is about the band The Matches. Anyone who's listened to my radio show knows how big a Matches fan I am. And that's it's such a big deal that she was on the show and we got to talk about what a great film it was. Slam Dance Film Festival that I saw it at, I managed to get a ticket and my God, it was good. If you can find it, do. But me and Chelsea talk about it and have a great chat. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Silent Mark Tries His Best, episode 5 with Chelsea Krister. How are you?
I'm doing all right. You know, hanging in there. You know, 2020 is, it feels like 2020 is finally coming to a close in some ways. So starting to feel that little light at the end of the tunnel get tiny bit bigger.
No, a tiny bit. Have you guys been managing to kind of stay safe and do what you need to throughout all this?
Yeah, I mean, I've been we've been pretty strictly quarantining to our apartment, you know, we've got a system. Been doing lots of cooking at home, you know, lots of, you know, big grocery shops so that we only go out, you know, once every 2.5 to 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a weird adjustment too, because my day job is, you know, like directing corporate videos, and so there's been a lot of having to learn how to remote direct through Zoom, which is very difficult and not quite the same, but you know, it's you do what you can to survive, and that's what we're trying to do.
Very, very true. That's kind of cool though that you're still able to do that from home. It's nice that you're getting there.
Yeah, I mean, it's I can't complain about the commute, that's for sure. I will say that, like, you know, I feel like directing is very much an in-person kind of energy feeling, you know, there's a lot that like needs to be exchanged in person and like nuances and behavior and like how everybody's doing in person that just can't quite translate through Zoom. Mm-hmm. And so while it's been like an incredible tool to still be able to have work, it's also just not quite the same. So I feel like once things actually start opening up, it'll just be really nice to be able to return to that kind of a feeling.
A team feeling as well, I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So
wonderful. Well, one thing I want to start off with, one thing I want to talk about, obviously we're going to talk about the movie in a bit anyway. What came first for you? Was it film or was it music?
Ooh, that's a great question. It's kind of blurred for me, but I think it was music first. Because, you know, I always was the like odd creative one in my family. And I didn't really have an outlet, you know, I didn't really know how to express those things or find like-minded people. And I remember, you know, I was always into like drawing or doodling or painting. And I got really into photography. And that was kind of my like aha moment is I loved visual storytelling. I loved being able to capture something in a frame. I loved doing portraiture. And then I started, you know, through my friends in high school, started learning about, oh, there's music you can listen to that's not on the radio. What a mind-blowing thing. And so I started to learn about independent music and went to a couple of my first shows. And I just got like really, it was just like finding yourself, you know, like you meet other people who are like-minded, you know, music to me is just like, it's just so therapeutic. And being at shows, like with all the energy, just the release. And a lot of the artists that I was listening, that I started to learn about and listen to at the time, just actually, you know, were artists that had things to say or things that like I could relate to. So it quickly became kind of an intersection of music and like storytelling in a way, because I started doing band photography a little bit as mm-hmm. like a teenager. I'd ask local bands to do photos for them. If bands were coming through town, I'd ask for a press pass because, hey, why not? You know, and just started to take photos of artists. But then from there, I took a couple video production classes and I just suddenly it became, you know, the other aha moment of, oh, like there's an intersection between all these things I love doing. Like there's the visual storytelling that comes with cinema in motion. And then you can also apply music and other, you know, and other really great things to tell a more complete story. So it just sort of evolved from there. But I mean, you know, ultimately, like I knew I wanted to go into film when I was a teenager and then went to film school. And so, you know, here we are.
Is it always the documentary side of it that had you hooked?
No, actually. I mean, I always did enjoy doing documentaries. I know when I was in film school, I took a couple of those, documentary classes. And, you know, they just came really naturally to me just because I'm an inherently curious person. Like I like asking people questions. I like talking to people and telling their stories. And so documentary films always kind of been a part of it. And most of the documentaries I made when I was in film school was like, they were music related. But for me, it's always been about narrative, you know, like started in scripted. I had a couple short films that were scripted and, you know, currently like, you know, concurrently with Making Bleeding Audio, I, you know, have written a few scripts and treatments. And so, you know, I'm eager to get back to scripted because there's a little more control there.
Yeah.
I like documentary film making will always have like, you know, a place in my heart.
And it's a good place. I mean, I was lucky enough to see the film. I saw it on the Slam Dance Festival. And without trying to be gushing, like get too gushing about it, stunning. Absolutely stunning. And for me, the Matches were always a band that you forget how good they are and how important they are until you'll listen to a track when your iPod's on shuffle, or you'll see a video of theirs, or you'll go to a gig where you didn't realize they were supporting. And then suddenly they're back in front of it again. The documentary reminded me how good they were. And so for you, what was the draw to the Matches with regards to wanting to tell their story?
Yeah, I mean, the Matches mean a lot to me, you know. They were one of those bands that I saw when I was a teenager where, you know, they blew my mind. Like they were amazing on stage. They just, you know, I went there to see another band and ended up becoming like as big of, if not a bigger fan of the Matches by the end of the night, you know. And you know, when I moved to the Bay Area for film school and the Matches were local, they were one of those bands that, you know, I asked again, like apparently I'm just very bold and just ask permission, but I
Same.
like asked them to
Same.
like do a little mini doc for one of my projects. And they said, yeah, sure, we'll be through town, you know. And you know, the Matches were so much more than a band to so many people because they not only, you know, connected with their fans on this one-on-one level. But I do feel like they were always so encouraging of people to pursue the lives that they wanted, specifically in art, you know? And I feel like that encouragement and that kind of presence that they had in that was just, it was infectious, you know? A lot of the people who loved this band, I feel like they were inspired to continue down a life of you know, creative endeavors because of them, you know, for better or
No,
worse.
very much so, yeah.
And I think that that was just like really powerful with them. And you know, it was also they were a band that had, you know, I have one friend who describes them as like they're like pop punk but smart. Like they've just got really good lyrics, and I've always really liked what they had to say. You know, I know as a teenager in like a pretty conservative, you know, super white town, like hearing songs like Sick Little Suicide that actually addresses, you know, like sexism and like, you know, the effects of media on women and, you know, their self-image. The fact that I was listening to a song that was addressing something that I was confronting and angry about from like that was just written by like four dudes, you know, it was really eye-opening for me to know that other people that weren't just, you know, women like or feminist killjoys, as I used to call myself, you know, that were angry about this, you know. And so anyway, just I'm kind of just blabbering on here, but they've always meant so much to me. And after doing that little mini doc with them when I was in film school, I you know, like I became friends, you know, like we all became really close and kept in touch over the years. Like I did some work for John's you know, subsequent project. And you know, when they decided to reunite, you know, they've done so much for me over the years. I wanted to support them. And so I offered to do just like little marketing videos to help them out, help promote the reunions. And of course, I was excited about it myself. But you know, when I was interviewing them, even as like an inner circle person, I was just captivated by their story. And there was so much that I didn't know, you know? And I've always been really fascinated by how the industry has changed for artists. And I've always really wanted to try and, you know, tell that story. And all the Matches milestones just kind of lined up very serendipitously with, well, you know, serendipitously, but like obviously with how the industry has shifted. And so it just seemed like this amazing opportunity to tell a bigger story. So, I asked their permission, and at first they were like, "What? No, you're crazy. Why would we're not interesting?" And I kind of fought for it a little bit more, and they gave me access and said, "Okay, you have our full support, but we're not really gonna help you make this because we don't want to make a documentary about ourselves." And I was like, "I don't expect you to. Just like, thank you for your support and blessing. I'm, you know, here we go." So here we are, seven years later.
And that's the thing. How it was, so I first came aware of it on Kickstarter, and they're a band that I've played quite a bit on radio over here in the UK, and for me they were definitely one of the few bands that I was like, people need to hear these, they need to be pushed out more, because of the strange stage presence, because of the music and things like that. So when you did the Kickstarter, I was plugging that like crazy on radio, just because I'm a whore like that. But the beauty of how the documentary started out, and then it's become a thing that people who don't even know the band and people who aren't into that type of music are still fascinated with the story. So much so that my parents, who know of them but aren't keen on the music, I was telling them a few stories from the documentary themselves, and they were fascinated. They wanted to know more. They were really curious
Oh.
about it. And how you got that from everything that went on was, again, as I said before, stunning, absolutely stunning.
Oh, thank you.
When you started it, was did you have the narrative in line anyway? Or with that type of documentary and that type of filmmaking, does it all come out through talking to those people?
It was a little bit of both, you know, with documentaries that are essentially telling like somebody's life story. I knew that I not only had a really compelling journey of, you know, a band, but also four really eclectic and eccentric and, you know, charming characters. Right. And so, so I knew that I wanted to follow something and tell a story that would engage a general audience. Like I knew that from the beginning. Is I think the unfair advantage we have is like Matches fans were going to love it no matter what. I mean, I know that sounds like a little arrogant, but I knew Matches fans would enjoy just seeing more of them. And so the goal with this was, hey, you know, we want to tell the Matches story, but we know the Matches story is, you know, is a bigger story. It's one that addresses what a lot of musicians went through in this era. And it's also, I think it's a great story of redemption too, and an even bigger story of community. So we knew we wanted to reach an audience that could understand those themes and be able to take something away from it themselves. And so when I wrote the initial treatment, you know, a lot of it was following, you know, the milestones of the band, paralleling that with like the milestones of the industry shifting. And so my interviews were constructed around that. You know, we kind of had this Venn diagram of, you know, people who only knew the Matches and their history, and then people who were experts in the music industry. And most of the people who are in the middle of that Venn diagram are the ones that remain in the film, because I did 55 insane, like 55 interviews for this movie. And, you know, there are a lot of other little offshoots and storylines we had considered doing, but we knew that this was really a rise and fall story. And so, you know, when I went into the edit, my first editor on the film, Jen Bradwell, who's a very experienced feature-length documentary editor, she's so talented, and she is, I mean, she is just amazing. And I gave her all the information, I gave her the treatment, I gave her like a full timeline of the Matches in their career and like a full download of the music industry and where I saw stuff overlapping, and just kind of let her alone with it for a couple months. And she came back with this amazing 2-hour and 40-minute long assembly, which honestly, most of that skeleton remains today. And so what we, you know, I basically ran out of money for Jen and she had another project coming up, full transparency. And so I ended up reaching out to one of my oldest friends. His name's Luke Schock. I've known him, you know, for 17 years, 13, 18 years now. And he and I had collaborated on basically all my other films. And so he generously decided to help me out in finishing this movie. And a big part of our workshopping with the narrative was definitely trying to bring it down to a lean 90 minutes, because I don't think documentaries need to be longer than 90 minutes, you know? I feel like most movies don't need to be longer than 90 minutes. But
I agree with you, but I'm also a massive nerd, so we'd still watch it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we did get it to an 1-hour and 45-minute cut, and I was like, nothing's changing ever. This is it. This is the one. And we had a you know, test screening with a bunch of very scrutinous people who made it very clear the 15 minutes that needed to be cut. So, you know, anyway. But what Luke and I did is, you know, we were noticing that a lot of the narrative moments and the character arcs that we had constructed just like were a little offbeat, like some of the pacing wasn't quite hitting those emotional moments in the way that you would want them to. So we actually like took the hero's journey and like used that as our guiding, you know, as our guiding way of like constructing the narrative and making sure that it like everything was, you know, feeling at a pace that people could connect with, and that it was that accessible form of storytelling. You know, we're so like everything we see is the hero's journey, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's some element of that that's very accessible. And so being able to take the Matches story and fit it into that accessible format, I feel like helped make the film as a whole something that was a good story instead of just a fan movie, you know? And that was always the goal with this movie, was for it to, you know, showcase a really unique band that deserved more credit. But, you know, whether you love the band at the end or not, and you listen to their music, I would hope that it's a conversation starter for, you know, what are these issues that exist in the industry? And if nothing else, at least you had a fun ride, you know, for 90 minutes.
So. No, and exactly. And you managed that. You did manage that because it does, as I say, it does have the appeal for Matches fans and the appeal for punk music fans in general, but then still goes further down the interesting route of why it became like that. And there's a big story nearer the end of the film where you find out more about what actually happened for the band and the reason why things were so stressed out. I don't want to spoil it because I'm desperate for people to see the film. But knowing that and knowing that that kind of stuff can happen is petrifying for a lot of people. And do you see that the music industry has changed for good now? Is there a continuation of this story, if you will?
I think if there's... I think the music industry and the way that it's constructed has always been kind of stacked against the artist. You know, I think if there's anything that the digital era has done that is really positive is it has democratized the ability for people to make music. So a lot of voices who wouldn't have otherwise been heard, like, are now able to create art and release it on their own terms, you know, with their own control. It's just now, you know, with democratization comes ubiquitousness, right? So like now, there's so many voices everywhere, you know, how does something rise to the top? And so that's kind of where the music industry, you know, the industry people come in to be able to, like, you know, amplify voices. And that's also where you start to lose control, you start to lose some autonomy. So I think no matter what, like, it's a, you know, it's a tough game out there. It's the same way with filmmakers right now too, you know, like there is a democratization of filmmaking with, you know, these phones we have that, you know, we can all, like, make a movie on our phone, but it's just, there's just so much saturation. And so if there's anything about the music industry that I think is starting to be kind of wrangled back into place is, you know, streaming was a solution, right? Like, suddenly there is monetization of music. People aren't just downloading it for free. We're finding a way to, like, actually track royalties. The issue is that streaming royalties were determined by the streaming platforms, which is not equitable for artists, right? You know, you've got, like, people at Spotify making, like, six-figure salaries, and you've got artists who make the platform successful getting, like, $3 checks, you know? So there's obviously something that's out of balance there. And so I hope that with the Music Modernization Act that actually passed in here in the States, I hope that there is some change in, like, streaming royalty payouts that is more equitable, because the other side of this too is that it's not equal payouts for everyone. It's like a sliding scale. So if you have 1 billion streams or you have, like, 100,000 streams, you don't get the same payout, you know, per stream. The person who has 1 billion streams gets, like, you know, exponential more than the person who has 100,000 streams, you know? Yeah. So it's just, it's not equal. Mm. So there is a lot that needs to be done. And if there's anything that I feel like Bleeding Audio addresses that, you know, I'm very passionate about as well, is, you know, live music is amazing. Touring is, like, a really cool experience for all artists to have, you know, being able to go around the globe and connect with fans. But touring is also not very sustainable, and it's not a very healthy lifestyle. And it was the band-aid that that came out of the digital era, which is, oh, if an artist is going to make money, they're just going to have to go out on tour. But, you know, it's a very high energy sport, especially if you're a Matches member. Oh, yeah. And it's something that, you know, touring for 10 months out of the year is just not a really great way to build a life. You know, it suits some people, but I would argue that it doesn't suit everyone. And it's not something that you can do for 20 straight years in a way that's healthy, you know? And so if there's anything that I feel like the pandemic has done is it's stress tested, or at least brought to light how unsustainable touring as a solution was for artists. Because that income was totally taken away. So then how does anyone in the music industry make money if you're not making money on touring? So I hope this, like, turns the camera a little bit away from touring and makes people go, hey, we should be looking over here at, like, you know, giving music monetary value again, instead of just making it something that we all, you know, kind of take for granted and feel entitled to, you know? So at least that's, like, kind of my feelings on it, is, like, you know, I'm going to be the first person to, like, jump into a live show pit, you know, as soon as we're all vaccinated and it's safe. But I also recognize that like artists touring that extensively isn't good for their mental or physical health, you know, and I would love for artists to tour less in order and be able to make more money off of the actual art instead of everything surrounding their art, you know, the t-shirt, the whatever, you know.
And another thing that this is kind of done, that the pandemic's done, is bring that live experience here through Zoom, through that type of thing, where, you know, we're talking from across the world, but it doesn't, it seems like we're right next to each other. There've been live band gigs, live streams, this, that, and the other all over. And it's not the same. It's not the same experience, but it is still something huge and something important. Do you think that's going to continue? And would you help it continue from your point of view?
Absolutely. I think something that isn't being spoken about enough is how us being forced into digital experiences and remote experiences, how much that's opened accessibility to the disabled community, to like other communities who might not be able to afford, you know, going to a live show, going to this talk, traveling to this thing. And I hope that what Zoom has done for us is made more companies more open to hiring remote workers, to allowing people to work from wherever they want to, you know, instead of having these pockets, you know, like I live in the Bay Area. It's insane. Like I'm never going to be able to buy a house here, you know, but like I've been working remote here in the Bay Area this whole time. Like maybe I could buy a house in like Tennessee, you know, and then like be able to remote work in. But more importantly is like, you know, there are a ton of people who were not allowed to work at certain companies because they couldn't come into the office because of their disability or because of some other reason. And now they have jobs and they're able to work remote because everybody else is working remote. So I hope things like that stick around and stay the same, you know, and like being able to see a live streamed concert is like really exciting for someone who might not be able to afford the in-person ticket, might not be able to like, you know, might not to be able to physically be at like a standing room only show, you know, like I think that there's an accessibility message that needs to be addressed with this. And I do hope it sticks around for that. I hope it doesn't just suddenly go away and alienate all these people who have finally been able to get access to a lot of opportunities and experiences. But of course, like, you know, I hope the in-person stuff, you know, starts picking back up soon too, because there are a lot of people who, you know, either make a living off of it or who do enjoy it and, you know, feed into that economy, you know? So it's a thing where, you know, we've had to, with Bleeding Audio at film festivals, we've had to get creative. We've had to, you know, kind of come up with ideas of how to have virtual experiences and things to like interact with people. And it's not the same as being in a theater. It's not. But we've been able to connect with people all over the world, and that's been really cool. And, you know, it's all about like creating that global feeling, you know, and I feel like that's been able to happen. So, you know, I think that there's, again, like pluses and minuses across the board. But to me, the thing at the tippy tops is the accessibility conversation that I think needs to be a bit louder. So that
yeah, it's not really spoken about. And that's quite a nice idea to kind of shout about it more. With Bleeding Audio and the film festivals, firstly, congratulations on your awards.
Thank you.
Well done. That is huge. That is that how it's a wanky question, but how does that feel?
I don't know. It's definitely it's been a roller coaster because, you know, this wasn't an easy movie to make. It's very hard to make a movie about a band no one's ever heard of. And, you know, we've had an incredible community supporting us to date. But, you know, like finding outside resources or, you know, financiers was just, you know, this is why it took 6 years to finish the movie. And then to have a world premiere on March 7th, 2020, you know, yeah, it's been a roller coaster.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So I definitely had a few months of just like, just the deepest, darkest depression of like, ah, hard work doesn't pay off. Everything, what, why, universe, why? And then, you know, we decided to pursue virtual festivals because we wanted to get the movie out there. And just the response has been just overwhelming, you know? When you put this much of your life and your soul into something, you know, it becomes inevitably becomes a part of you. And so for it to be received and winning awards is, I mean, I'm super proud of the movie. I feel like, you know, we put so much work and love into it and I love where it is, but you know, like I'm the director, I see all the warts, you know, like, you know, and
you'll watch it still and go, oh, that needs taken out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like I still have those moments. But like, I am proud of it. And it basically, the response that it's getting is the response that I dreamed of. And so the fact that we have like, you know, 7 awards for the film is humbling, and I'm very grateful for the reception. And I don't know how to feel about it sometimes, but it feels really good. So
I'm guessing overwhelming and just kind of, yeah, you know, you're not quite sure how to, you've got something there, but you don't know how to describe it.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, oh God, like I felt so bad because there was this festival that, you know, gave us an acceptance letter and wanted to screen the film. And, you know, it was a time when I could not dedicate, I just couldn't allocate any resources or bandwidth of myself to help promote the festival or participate, you know? And so I said, hey, like, maybe we could try next year, or, you know, cause I just don't think I'm gonna be able to give you the experience that I want you to have with us. And they're like, no, it's fine. Like, we got this. Like, if you can just do the Q&A, we'll be fine. I was like, okay, if you're sure, but like, I'm really not gonna be able to promote it on social media. I just don't. And they're like, yeah, it's fine. And I was like, okay. And I just remember feeling so bad, but like, I had nothing left in me. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the festival, I was just kind of scrolling through Twitter, about to go to bed. And like, we won Best Feature at that festival. And I just remember sitting there being like, wait, what's happening? What's happening? Like, I didn't get a chance to support, and they like are so kind. And I mean, like, here it is. Like, I have like an actual trophy. Like,
it's, you have just... and it's proper like new trophy award shape as well. And that's beautiful.
So it was really nice, but it's just like, you know, it's just so humbling, you know. I don't know, it feels really lame. I just picked up a trophy and showed it.
That's fine. No, you don't regret it. It's fine. That's good.
But yeah, it's been a crazy journey. And especially, you know, the highs and lows of the pandemic. It's cool to be here, you know, navigating through to almost the other side. We're getting there.
Yeah, we hope so. Are you going to tour the film afterwards when the world has opened up again, do you think?
I sure hope so. That was a part of our original plan was, I mean, frankly, we were going to tour it around film festivals and, you know, do film festivals, maybe bring the matches along. And so now the hope is to land that distribution deal, you know, finalize some stuff for distribution. And then I would love to do an indie film, like an indie theater circuit, and go around, do some Q&As, and then, you know, maybe bring some matches with me once they're ready, and do a few little live shows.
I'm disgusted on their reunion they didn't come over here. So the deal is, we'll get you over here. We'll get you on some film festivals here. Bring them over as well.
Okay. We should work it out because going to the UK is really expensive. So
yes, it is.
I know that's the only reason why they haven't been there yet.
No, okay, I totally understand it.
But I know they want to go back. I know they really, really want to go back. So
do you think there is a future for the band?
I think for the matches, and I think what's really special about what they have is they had a redemption story, or at least like they were able to have that reunion and feel validated for all the work that they did, you know, like they're able to reach an audience, and it's not, you know, becoming a household name, but it's becoming like a permanent place in a lot of people's hearts, you know, which is like big. And I think that they have an appreciation for it in a way that they just didn't before that first reunion. And so you know, like the matches can be their part-time thing now. It's something that, you know, there's no pressure for it to be the full-time gig. And so I think they're able to come to the matches in a much healthier place and be able to create within, you know, the project that is the matches and tour, you know, whatever is the project that is the matches, in a way that like fits into their lives instead of forces its way in, you know? Yeah. So, you know, the pandemic derailed a bunch of plans that they had and that I had with them. Mm. And so I'm hoping that we're able to pick back up those plans sometime this year or maybe early next year.
Mm. And it's proof, if proof were needed, that having a band like this as a part of your life rather than the part of your life, a perfect example of that would be Life of a Match, which after album four, Cards on the Table, I wasn't keen on it. It wasn't for me, I don't think.
Well, album four, I don't know if you know the story behind it, but it was just a demo dump, you know?
Right, okay, it's so like, that'll be
they
why.
Like literally had a bunch of demos and they were like, there's no reason for us to hold on to these. We should just give them to fans because what else are we going to do with them? You know, I especially think because at the time there was no intention to reunite whatsoever, you know? So it was more of like okay, these are unfinished demos. Here you go.
Yeah. But then Life of a Match came out and it felt like a song that was like 6 years in the making, a song that it felt like it had been written for that length of time. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think what was really funny about the production process for Bleeding Audio is like, I had this very like clean and clear timeline. And then the guys informed me that they were going to like record new music. And I thought, oh, this is the perfect ending of the movie. Like the reunion inspires new art. Oh, it's like so magical. And so I, you know, took like delayed everything 6 months to like diligently record their process, which was a lot of like remoting in, a lot of like piecemeal recording sessions, only to find that like not a frame of that footage exists in the doc. What was really cool to witness was just seeing them like be the matches again in like a creative and way, and also like what that meant to them today. And I feel like Life of a Match is a song that like really does, you know, it's very meta, obviously it's called Life of a Match for God's sake. And you know, it is a reflection on that whole time in the industry of all the bands that, you know, were caught in the crossfire of those, you know, changes, what prevails, what doesn't, you know. And it was an ode to that era. And it was like, you know, it's kind of a bittersweet tune about all the people who didn't make it through. Mm. But also just like how disposable a lot of, like we treat a lot of our artists, you know, like it is kind of like the churn is just so fast and so great, you know, like those massive arena bands just aren't really going to exist anymore. It's always kind of the next new thing. Mm. And so, yeah, it's interesting. Like I find the tune a little hopeful, but definitely a little, you know, a little cheeky in terms of just what the state of our industry is. And hopefully we can find a way to just value our artists more and so they can stick around, you know?
Mm. It's bringing that air of passion back to music and meaning. So a band that I think kind of, the Matches did it perfectly when they were producing music. Life of a Match was again another example of that. But then another band that kind of bring lyrics and meaning and passion to everything, or a band like Motion City Soundtrack and Justin Courtney Pierre's solo work is another example of it. Just such passion and beauty and heartbreak and everything in a song.
I mean, the band that you know, drew me to the live show that got me into the Matches was Motion City. You know, like Motion City Soundtrack is still one of my all-time favorite bands, and I'm very fortunate now to, you know, call Justin like a friend. I was very fortunate to get like a little early peek into into the Justin's most recent EP, The Anthropologist on Mars. Mm. And it's so good.
Beautiful.
He's such a good songwriter. It's so annoying how good he is.
Oh, yeah. No.
Like, how do you be this consistently good for 20 years, man? God damn it.
Yeah. No, I know that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, his songs mean a lot. I've got that on my arm.
Oh, hello.
But.
Hi, that's cool. Oh my God, I love it.
So yeah, LGFUAD, song that means the world to me. That came out of it. And the again, yeah, online, the amount of people that saw it and went, why did I not fucking think of that? I love it. But anyway, with those bands that mean so much to you, you put a lot of your voice and kind of passion from that voice in the film. It's a strange question, but with we know what you want to say with Bleeding Audio. What else do you want to say with your work?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Bleeding Audio definitely galvanized me about how artists are treated in the industry. You know, like that's definitely clear in a lot of what I've already like ranted about in our, you know, conversation today. And so a lot of what I'm writing has like some elements of, you know, exposing, you know, the truths behind the industry or just involving musicians. Cause I feel like, you know, we see these stories of rock stars. We see this like VH1 Behind the Music, and it's just like sex, drugs, rock and roll, the glamour of touring. And it's just a facade, you know, like there's a lot of like humanity and heartbreak that happens behind the scenes that I just feel like isn't talked about. And to me, you know, I know we just went through a pandemic, but I feel like there's another epidemic that's happening right now. And it's one of like musicians' mental health. And a lot of it is the impact of touring extensively. And so, you know, one of the scripts that I've been working on in the background while finishing Bleeding Audio is one that follows an artist's journey after being forced to leave his band, you know, and just the kind of stunted adolescence, you know, the extended adolescence, you know, that comes from a life on the road, you know, kind of missing out on a lot of key maturity moments in your 20s and just trying to build a life with a plan B that you don't really have a plan B for, you know? Mm. And so that's, you know, one script I'm working on, but, you know, other stories I love telling and, you know, something that I think definitely inspired me through Bleeding Audio and the matches and the musician stories that I've learned is just how infectious and powerful passion is and having a dream. You know, I love exploring stories where you choose to follow a dream and you have to learn about the sacrifice and hard work that goes into it. And just like, just being able to see the truth of what that takes, you know, on like a personal toll, you know, toll on relationships. And not to like sound so bleak, I think there's a lot of positive stuff that comes in that too. But I feel like there's, you know, there's such like a, oh, you know, get famous quick or, you know, get up on YouTube and suddenly you're a star kind of thing. And I feel like we kind of ignore the hard work that goes along the way.
Yeah.
And then I think too, we forget the value in quitting something, you know, so many people have so many paths in their lives. And I feel like sometimes, you know, passion can also turn into obsession, and great films that explore that are, you know, movies like Whiplash or, you know, Black Swan, where it shows just like the pure obsession that can come with having a dream, but also how that can, you know, maybe not be the healthiest life choice and kind of turn you into, instead of a hero, like the anti-hero, you know? And so, yeah, I'm super interested in those kinds of human stories and just, you know, navigating that world. So, yeah, I guess
I do like that. I'm very conscious of time. I know you're on your break at the moment. Thank you very much for doing this. What's next for you?
I just actually directed my first TV broadcast spot. It's with Poshmark and Marie Kondo. And I'm looking into maybe directing some more commercials for TV. But what I would love to do next is actually start directing television and start directing, or at least, you know, start developing my next feature length project, mm-hmm. Which will be scripted this time.
It will be.
Yes. people ask me, oh, like, what's your next documentary going to be? And I'm just like, funded. So
Yes.
If somebody wants me to direct a documentary, please consider me, but it'll be on your budget, not my savings account budget. But anyway, I have some scripts, I have some treatments, I have, you know, a bunch of stuff that I really want to make next. And what kind of spurned bleeding audio is, I was in that post-project depression, right? Like, I just didn't know what my next project was going to be. I knew I wanted to do a feature, and the story just kind of came to me. It just kind of fell in my lap. And so I was able to make Bleeding Audio. It did take 6 years. And so, there were definitely times where I felt divergent from the film. I was just like, oh, I just want to make something else. So I feel like I've been able to, parsing away from my time on Bleeding Audio, kind of prepare a slate that I'm really excited about. Mm-hmm. And it would just be about, finding the right production company or somebody or producer to partner with. And, let's go. Like, I'm ready. Like, let's make a movie.
Love it. Absolutely love it. So the movie, is it still on different festivals, or are you kind of done with all that now?
So we are starting to kind of trail the end of our festival run. We do have a number of festivals coming up. I'm not sure all of them that I can announce, but most of them are in the US. We are going to be screening at, when is this being released?
This, hopefully next Monday.
Next Monday. Okay. So we're just wrapping up at the Oxford Film Festival in Mississippi. We are going to be screening at the Milwaukee Film Festival in Wisconsin. We'll mm-hmm. be screening at the Indy Film Festival in Indiana. We've got, and this is what I'm really excited about, we're going to be screening at the Julian Dubuc International Film Festival in Iowa, and I will get to be there in person for Amazing. An actual movie theater screening.
You'll be able to see people watching your film.
Oh my God. Yeah. I'm getting like choked up even thinking about it, but I'll actually get to sit in a theater and watch the film. So I'm very excited about that. That's happening later in April. We also have been selected as part of the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival in Australia. Oh, wow. And they're doing like a very special music doco day in a couple weeks. And so Bleeding Audio is going to be playing in between a Beatles doc and a Radiohead doc. And I just whole brain exploded when they sent the lineup.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So that's very exciting. Yeah, there's a few other odds and ends here and there, but really what we're trying to do now is we're hoping to do some more international film festivals. I know there's a few UK festivals I got my eye on, and I'm hoping that we can get a distribution deal wrapped up and actually release the film in the fall, maybe? I don't know.
We can hope.
We can hope. Fingers
genuinely,
crossed.
I only just saw it a couple of months back, desperate to see it again. It's one of those that it's definitely one for repeat viewing. So we can watch and see what you guys are doing at bleeding_audio on Twitter.
Yes.
Your one on Twitter is?
Oh, I'm at Chelsmark on Twitter, but there that could change.
It might do. There's the website bleedingaudiomovie.com.
So, our website is
bleeding-audio.com.
And then our Instagram is at Bleeding Audio Film. And then you can find us on Facebook at Bleeding Audio. And then I'm on Instagram also. I'm at Chelsea Krister. And then Twitter, like, you can just search Chelsea Krister and you'll find me.
Do it. I'll post links and stuff. Chelsea, thank you so much for doing this today. It means the absolute world to me. Ladies and gentlemen, Chelsea Krister.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
And there we go. That was episode 5 with Chelsea. Again, Chelsea, thank you so much for doing that. Thank you to Cher as well for helping set it up. The interview blew me away at how open and honest she was about everything, and it was such a lovely chat. Please, if you can, go to any of the gigs that are coming about, go to any of the festivals that are playing the show, the film, sorry, and then as soon as you can, go and get the go and get the film, because it's fucking tremendous. Next episode, I'm not too sure. Again, a couple of things in the pipeline. But if you want to be on the podcast, or if you want anyone to be on the podcast, do get in touch with me, mark@silentmark.co.uk. Keep an eye on the website. I will be updating it. But that is it for today's show. Thank you so much for joining me today. And we shall see you next time. Take it away, Pops.
Silent Mark tries his best. Was thought of and presented by Silent Mark. The cover photo was taken by Tony Knox at Alpha Omega Wrestling. The music was by my Uncle John's band, Weird Atlas. Go to patreon.com/silentmark to support putting me through school. My name is Silent Props. Love you, bye!
Look up.